This is Articulate Warbling with Zach and Laura. Recorded in England. Edited and produced in the United States. Thank you and enjoy. To find out more about the show, check the show notes or go to Articulate Warbling on Facebook or follow Zach at Sweat Drenched Rit on Instagram or just Google Sweat Drenched Press for Zach's website. Here we go. Zach and Laura, Articulate Warbling. Glad to see y'all back.
Hello, this is Zach of Articulate Warbling. Today we have a very special episode where Richard Cabot will talk a little bit about his work, Dark Entries. We'll also feature a reading from him. Also, after Richard Cabot has warbled along, quite fittingly and quite kindly for us, I will be reviewing Dark Entries, a book I very much enjoyed. Following that, then, will be Rebecca Granston with her own reading for her work, Sea of Glass. And following that will be the final review for this episode. I do want to apologise for the authors and people in question involved in this. It's taken a very long time, a lot of mishaps, a lot of ups and downs all around, some missing files that were missing, but files that were in plain sight. But here it is, a special episode that's dedicated to two very talented authors. Richard Cabot, he writes very transgressive punk rock, very psychological dramas and character pieces, whereas Rebecca Granston shares in the sense that she writes stuff that is pure literature, literary, and Sea of Glass is something that she herself has said isn't of her norm, isn't something she specialises in. It's more, a little bit more experimental. It is quite innovative, and I like seeing artists experimenting and playing, and what she reflects in this evolution as an artist is very exciting. But I'm warbling on too much, so the next 16 minutes is dedicated to Richard Cabot following my review. And then I've repeated this, but this is why it's called Articulate Warbling. Rebecca will be with you for a good 8 minutes reading from Sea of Glass, and then will be my short but sweet review for Sea of Glass. And yeah, just let's get on with the show.
Hi, Articulate Warbling podcast listeners. My name is Richard Cabot, and please rest assured I'm going to warble in as articulate a manner as I possibly can. I'm a writer living in sunny southeast London, on Oak Park to be exact, and my latest book is called Dark Entries. But to give a little background for people who may not know me that well, I started writing in the early 80s for the NME, the New Musical Express, under the name Richard North, named so because I was at that time squatting in a place called New North Road near Old Street, and I didn't want the Dole, I was signing on at the time, to know. I wrote the fairly infamous Positive Punk front cover article for the paper about a bunch of colourful bands and people, including Brigandage, a band I then joined on bass, which made it a little confusing. But hey, shortly after, Positive Punk turned into goth, although with different bands and people. Matthew Worley, who wrote a book called No Future, Punk Politics and British Youth Culture, he said in that book, Richard Cabot, brackets Richard North, was the first to outline the basis of what eventually became codified as goth. Hey, so sorry about that. I'm warbling, aren't I? I went on to write for other music mags like Zigzag, and then I went, then I worked for the BBC for a few years. And more recently, I've been writing plays and books, including one called Punk is Dead, Modernity Killed Every Night for Zero Books, which went down pretty well with people and the reviewers, and if that matters. It's an anthology I edited really about the ideas behind punk, the spectacle, the sex, the style, rather than just the music. There's so many books about punk, but I think even though I say so myself, Modernity Killed Every Night has something lacking in other narratives. which is a bit of personality humour, albeit a mad laughter, and a sense of lyricism. My latest book, meanwhile, is, as aforementioned, a novel called Dark Entries, which is why I'm here on Articulate Warbling. I guess the book, to introduce it a little bit, it's about the contemporary psyche. It's quite savage and brutal, but honest, and it's a peak modern lifestyle characterised by aimlessness and self-abuse via reliance on extreme pornography and alcohol, and a bit of drugs thrown in for good measure. So it's all about, it's also about addiction and depression. Containing an atmosphere laden with sexual anxiety and frustration, the book is both a psychopulp and an urban blues. This book has also gone down pretty well with cool people, the sort of people who would and are listening to this great podcast. What a stunning graphic sign of the fucking times, said, for instance, Lou Reed. Not the Lou Reed, but I'm sure he would have said it too if he was alive. But Lou Reed, who is a singer with the band Lola and the Slacks from Glasgow. I've had a few of those kind of comments, and but other people are kind of disturbed by it, but those are the sort of people who probably need to be disturbed. If anyone wants a copy or wants to find out about what I'm up to, or more about what I'm up to, including a new play, Now I Want to Be Your Dog, and prose work, Looking for a Kiss, they're in the works, then the easiest thing to do is to contact me via my website, richardcabot.com. Cabot is spelled C-A-B-U-T, richardcabot.com. Meanwhile, before I stop warbling, the lovely Zach has asked me to read a bit of the book out. The book is actually centred around a guy called Ray, who is based actually on someone who is quite close to me. He's the protagonist. But I'd actually like to read a bit of the book that's about Ray's girlfriend. It's an important part of her story and impacts on Ray himself. Thank you for listening. Yeah, it's good to be polite, isn't it? And here is a dark entry. One weekend, while Ray was visiting his mother, his girlfriend was having a bad and boring time. Earlier, on Commercial Street, she had seen a black cat, unlucky enough to have been hit by a car or been given a vicious kicking by some particularly stupid and sadistic kids. With cracked back and smashed head, the broken little beast flipped around like a landed fish in the middle of the road. Eyes rolled and blood sprayed from a shattered mouth as the cat danced its violent death flip. She shuddered and moved on. Her universe, full of portents and signs, was marked by a sense of melancholy, isolation, and the stomach-churning premonition that it is all going to go tits up. This is a bad sign, she thought. Ray and his girlfriend live in Nunhead, near the Peckham. Here, there is no only fools and stalls, horses, jollity, but plenty of fucking fools, though, she thinks, and I am one of them. She tries to cure her boredom in the usual way, with a few pints. She ends up in the Duke of Connaught, a decidedly dodgy boozer, where she is soon the nub of the hubbub. Tottering precariously from one drinker to another, she drunkenly flirts a little. She does not even bother to think, what harm is there in that? Her conversation is loaded with trash innuendo and outrage, harmless nonsense. Rubbish one-liners, ah, the blessings of talking bollocks. Some in the Connaught, though, are annoyed by her pissed and cocky craziness. They think of her as provocative. She gets some funny looks from some very unfunny geezers. Beer monsters, seemingly disgorged by some dark underground. And none of it isn't even on the tube. She should be careful. "The best thing about being a bloke," says one bloke to some other blokes while wiping lager spillage from his face, "is it even is going to the toilet is a bonus, a plus." Eyebrows are raised in puzzlement. "When I have a slash," she continues, "and I've finished, yeah, yeah, well, I sometimes squeeze instead of shake. Yeah, I'm going for a piss right now," he laughs. The other's jeer is back, making wanker signs. He turns around, leering stupidly, a stare caught by Ray's girlfriend, who thinks and maybe signals, "What a tosser. Be careful." There are others in the pub who would not dare to talk out loud about their toilet habits or their little peccadillos. One bloke, for instance, has the antisocial custom of, while in other people's bathrooms, wiping his dirty penis on their towels. Later, he fantasizes about his most private of parts, has no doubt touched the faces, lips of women, his mates, wives and daughters, who have used those towels. This bloke looks at Ray's girlfriend as she passes. "I ate ugly birds," he says. "They're all right," says another bloke. "How'd you make that out?" "They're ugly, you can do what you fucking want to them in bed. Things you wouldn't dare do to a good-looking bird. You can be as horrible as you want. And they take it because they know they're ugly and they're lucky to get anything at all. Even if it's a slap and a kick, they're grateful. And then you boot them out in the morning." "Reminds me of the 60s, says another older bloke who had spent the first summer of love spreading diseases. Ray's girlfriend vaguely hears this conversation and absorbs it through the fuzz of booze. Her energy has dissipated to the extent that she thinks about getting home, navigating the endless possibilities of council estates, sweltering in the summer night. The place is floundering, dying from lack. Lack of what? What haven't you got? Be careful. "So this machine," pontificates a bloke at the bar, whose face suddenly contorts in anger after noticing his newly poured pint of bitter. "Oi, darling, I said lager," he screams at the barmaid. "I thought you wanted," she starts. "No," he says. I thought, she half whispers and stutters. "Listen, darling," he says, making sure he's got the attention of all the blokes at the bar. "Don't think. What you want to do is take another tablet, love. Take another pill to help you with your head. Because this pill, the one you've obviously been taking, you've been taking a pill, ain't you?" "No," she replies. "Yeah," he said, "you have. Some sort of smart pill, right? But it ain't doing nothing for you, because you're still fucking stupid. You need something to make you a bit cleverer, girl. You need a clever pill. And until you get one, just do us a favour and don't think." Everyone laughs at the red-faced barmaid pours another pint of lager. "Sold a machine for 400 quid, continues the bloke, who is interrupted by the barmaid trying to make amends by joining in with the mob. "Why?" she inquires about the machine. The man looks at her, and then at his friends, and then at the barmaid again. "Do you want me to draw you a diagram, love?" he says. "But paint you a picture, darling. But do a little Picasso so you can see what I'm fucking on about." He shouts, "It's not fucking rocket science!" More laughter. Ray's girlfriend, suffering from alcohol, makes it to the toilet cubicle, drool coming out of her mouth, but avoids being sick. "Fuck," she says, "fuck, fuck, fuck," and wishes she hadn't given her number to a couple of the pub psychos before she realised they were animals. Wishes she hadn't told the mental geezer with the toupee that he could walk home with her. Wishes she hadn't said at the bar, "I don't care if people think I'm a slag, just because I like chatting to blokes. I don't care." Some people, she now thinks, may have taken it the wrong way. Ray's girlfriend smells of lager and lime and regret. Ray's girlfriend does care. The graffiti on the cubicle door reads, "Stuck? Have a wank." "Yeah, right," she thinks. Instead, she pulls out her mobile. A few people look on expectantly as she walks out of the bog. For instance, the bloke, bulging with hang-ups and depravities, who all evening has been puzzling about the lengths of Ray's girlfriend's toenails and the state of her underpants. He wonders, slightly soiled or rank? And the other bloke, who, if he could be bothered, would feel really bad about the type of porn he watches. Just like Ray. As Ray's girlfriend moves away from them in the direction of the door, a few men stand up to follow. A bad energy envelops everything. Outside, a trashed old couch springs uncoiling, nestles in the corner of some waste ground. A small black cat slinks through the humid evening. There is a squeal of tire rubber on tarmac. She stops. So do the men. Another bloke looks up from his magazine, then quotes to his mate, "Why are tales of poor people, the underclass who encounter daily aggro, crime, humiliation, disappointment and death, so titillating to literary thrill seekers looking for books in which dirt is a credential of reality?" There is no answer. Ray's girlfriend gulps. The men smile. Suddenly, the door opens. A bloke walks in. "Minicab?" he asks. "Yeah," says Ray's girlfriend. She breathes an audible sigh of relief. But the sense of disappointment emanating from the men is almost palpable, and compensatory rounds are ordered. The cab driver looks around the boozer, takes in the vicious vibe, and leads Ray's girlfriend by the arm. "Come on," he says, "let's go, quickly." Giving a parting V-sign to the blokes, she stumbles out of the door. Once more, she has looked into the abyss, but managed to break off the hypnotic, calamitous gaze before being sucked in. "It was getting really iffy in there," she says to the cabbie. "Glad you came so quick, my saviour." "Come on," he pulls, his grip tightening on her arm. "Well, where's your cab?" she asks. "Don't worry," he says. "It's just around the corner." He points to somewhere vague, dark and desolate. There is a silence for a minute while things sink in. "Be careful out there." Too late. "Front or back?" he asks rhetorically as they approach his car. "Front or back? You couldn't make it up," she thinks, dragged into the undertow of a dreadful dream. A silence in which a truth can be clankingly confronted. One that makes clear that in real life, as in unreal fiction or melodrama, those who suffer from the devil's own luck, or who have no prospects and who have been given a raw deal, are only allowed to avoid an awful predicament in order to face an even more terrible one. That's the rules. "You couldn't make it up," says Ray's girlfriend, to no one really.
The theatre was empty, brighter. He could see more of it through the gloomy light this time, though its edges remained elusive. He wouldn't dawdle in the place. The feeling that someone had only just coughed and left the room hit him. He rushed to where he'd found the way out before, the doorway in the dark he'd hurt himself trying to round. Now in the twilight of the stage there was no door, only plaster and paint, an oddness to its colour. The pit hummed at him, calling him forward, inviting his compliance. If he didn't want to be stuck, he'd have to move through didactic pathways, sacrifice his will to self-govern in extremis, and resolve to temporarily surrender to whatever capricious assholes turned the cogs of the place. He took the old steps to the stage floor and wandered to where the builder had sat. The pit was still and shadowy, no hint of the struggle that had taken place within. The emptiness soothed him, and he allowed himself a pause to willfully forget about his exit. Under the theatre light that fell on him, especially his face. Name, take to the centre and forsake the mask. Wear your best, then let her undress you. All the moments flicker past in her. You stole her, you know. Hustled her like a numbskull in fluke. Couldn't ride her waves incandescent. So she spat you out poisoned chalice style. Her movements, Pyrrhic victories you'd hold against her, because she shone her fractured light on your want. Now you wander, umbilical, precipitating perfected shits, walking away, forever walking away. Ketar moved to backstage, around the chipboard blank scenery, wires hanging disconnected, copper and rubber tubes, nails in the walls. A power box was fixed to the wall, near some steps leading into a dark way back farther. He opened the box, full of switches with stickers and worn-away diagrams for instruction. One switch glowed green, so he flicked it. Music filled the room, muffled from out front in the theatre. Closer, the sound of whirring machinery sprung into life, grating and squelchy. Rumbling travelled from the stage on the other side of the scenery. He hesitantly moved to retrace his footsteps, peeping around the splintered wood to spy the open stage floor. There in the middle of the stage, the flooring opening up, a square trapdoor controlled by robotic pulleys. From below, a bulk rose, difficult to see to make out at first, rounded and bent. It pushed from beneath, a portion of it caught under the sides of the trapdoor. The trapdoor gave and a foot sprung up, dirty and bruised. The body ascended, twisted, inverted, guided by rope, flopping at the knees, cracked skew-if at the ribcage. Discordant, grimy guitars rattled in minor chords, reverb in a whirlwind around the theatre. Her thighs ready to split, like an unpicked sausage. Someone's daughter. Someone's daughter. If this is Anna, then that's too bad. The woman's dress had fallen inside out and over her face, her hands peeking out from under the hanging material with wrists bound. A tattered bra rotted into her skin, the rest of her naked and bare. Someone had stripped her, hoisted her up, hidden, faceless. Ketar couldn't decide how to react. The sight of her was a world. The dress was stained with dirt, excrement, patches of fluids. He found a clear section of hem and lifted it to confirm her deadness. The shadow underneath showed a face beaten and shocked, lacerated cheeks pointing to a forehead with letters carved. The right way up for him, upside down for the woman. Queen of worms, it said in bloody cuts, as worms slimed through her hair and bawled, squirming inside the hole of her open mouth. Her eyes were shut. Ketar dropped the hem of the dress, which fluttered back to cover the woman and her worms. This felt forensic. His neck hairs prickled like he was under observation, a study on stage. Now who was making him an actor? Shitty move, thinks it's clever, but the body is real enough. The music tore his nerves, wearing him down, twangs turning into fuzzbox mush, distorted whines, percussive and deconstructing feedback until his ears pounded hot. Was it louder or he more sensitive? There was something in the music he couldn't background anymore. Squinty, he glanced at the pit, but all was vacuum. Blue flames emerged from her fingertips, softly curling them. The blue grew, flowed ethereally across her hands, took hold on the binding of her wrists, turning to warm orange, flickering faster. The binds burned away, and her arms swung free, her hands alight, flung sideways, rocking to and fro. The flames travelled along her arms and ignited the dress, which burned with white intensity up her frame. At this, the body screamed and gurgled, expelling worms in a cascading arc, contorting against the flames. Violent as the yells were, they carried an unnatural music, frequencies spectral. Katar stood transfixed with astounded curiosity, because she sounded long dead. The flash of fire enveloped her, and a wriggling cocoon of light undulated, spitting cinders and rolling sparks. Katar held out his hand, reaching cautiously to find no heat to the flame. The sparks at his feet travelled over the dark floor to catch every wiggling worm and crisp them up on collision, leaving charred pellets in their place. Mid-flow, the smouldering briquettes briefly formed the words "Find Espe" in fierce orange before continuing to scatter and then cool to coal dust. The light on the woman diminished and she hung blackened, swinging gently, tannery shine like midnight. Recorded on the night of the Worm Moon, 2020.
So that was Rebecca Grandston talking about, well, doing a reading actually, for Sea of Glass, her sensational short novel. I don't really want to go into specifics about this book, about the narrative, as usually is my want when I do these reviews. I like to leave some form of mystique, but I like to usually talk about the machinations, the prose, and the overall intimacy of the reading, the experience of reading it. And there's something very Ballardian about Rebecca's prose. There is very broad connotations, and also there's this very surrealistic edge and verve to her work, something that I could really, well, it's to do with the stilted, sparse prose, and there's something very Elaine Rob-Grillet about it as well as, but being wholly unique, its own thing, there's this dread, and considering the current climate of COVID-19, it's quite an apt reading, though the outbreak in question in this story is not that of a virus, but there's something virus-like. There's an infection in the prose, in the narratives, in the atmospherics, in the structure. It comes across almost as a hallucinogenic experience, something that you would sweat out, a dislocation, a bib bobbing, flitting in and out of consciousness and some semi form of conscious state. The book is ingenious in the fact that though it does have a narrative, it does have a broader through line, beginning, middle and end, it's stilted almost off-kilter, off-centred extrapolation of character, place, tonality. It just reinforces the strength of what she is telling you for the atmospherics, for how it's organisationally put together. It's a very detailed, very compelling, very almost enigmatically uncomfortable reading experience, and I recommend you pick up a copy. And I wish to thank Richard Cabot and Rebecca Grandston themselves for contributing to this podcast. Please seek out their works. Please seek them out on any social media platform that you can find them on. And that is me for today's episode.
This has been Articulate Warbling. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe everywhere that you listen to your podcasts. Tell your friends about it. I don't know. Buy Zach's t-shirt. Thanks for listening to the show. Recorded by Zach and Laura in Brighton, England. edited and produced by DB Spitzer in Portland, Oregon. All right. Thanks.